Hello, and welcome to Amen Talks, the affiliate and partner marketing podcast. I'm your host, Rob Davidson from Awin's Global Strategy Team, and I'm joined today by my usual co-host, Kevin Edwards, Awin's Global Strategy Director. And we are back for a brand new year of affiliate industry chat. So, how are you, Kev?
I'm very well, thanks, Rob. How are you?
Not bad, thanks. Has the new year gotten off to a good start?
Yeah, it's all right. I mean, I had the first week of January off, which is always quite nice.
Yes.
Yeah. Eased myself slowly into the year.
Have you made any resolutions for the new year?
Do fewer of these podcasts.
Okay, yeah, we'll see how that pans out. On this month's edition of Awin Talks, we are inevitably talking about the future. So it's the start of a new year, and it's an appropriate time to be thinking about what new trends, developments, and changes we might anticipate occurring in the coming months ahead in the industry. So with that in mind, today's podcast isn't the only source of future gazing you can access from Awin. Just last week, we held our first event of the year with a two-day webinar series that honed in on a few key topics that will be influential in 2023. On the first day, I was joined by Awin's Global Legal Director, Isla Saroz. I think, have I pronounced that correctly?
I don't know. I just call her Isla.
Isla, yeah. With Isla. And one of our senior product leads, Stephen Short, to talk about the likely direction of regulation and tracking in the industry this year. And on day two, I was joined by Awin's Global Publisher Director, Jasper Mulder, and yourself, of course, Kev, for a discussion around publisher and wider industry trends to look out for in 2023. So the recordings from those webinars are going to be available to stream on Awin's YouTube channel shortly, and I'll drop links to those onto the landing page for this episode on the Awin blog if you'd like to have a watch. And also on the blog, you can read our top 10 affiliate predictions for 2023, some of which we'll talk about today and will show up in that article inevitably because I wrote it. But if you're keen to see all 10 predictions, then do check that article out, and I'll link to that from this episode's page. However, for today's podcast, we wanted to get a couple of external perspectives on likely industry trends this year. And so we have in the room with us two affiliate veterans. I'm sure they don't mind describing them that way.
I mean, it's too late now, isn't it?
Well, I was about to say, yeah. It's in the podcast, so you're stuck with that, I'm afraid. And they hopefully can help us provide some valuable thoughts on where the industry might be heading over the coming months. So first of all, Helen Southgate, Chief Global Officer at the agency Acceleration Partners. I've got to quickly ask you, actually, Chief Global Officer.
Yeah.
What is that title?
That's a very good question, Rob. It basically does global stuff is the best way to describe it. But there's,
that's handy.
It's just like really important hard work. No, so it's basically two areas. One is being responsible for our global strategy. So things that we roll out. So, for example, we are now working in influencer space. We're looking at some other products and services. My role is like, how do we roll that out to the rest of the world and do it in a way that sort of fits the market and culture, etc. Then the other side of my role is around global expansion. So where should we be to service our clients? Where can we develop and grow? So it's been interesting, an interesting year.
Good. Well, also joining us in the room, we've got Chris Johnson, Chief Operating Officer at the technology partner Intently. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Rob. Nice to put some face to that. Those dulcet tones that you hear a lot of the time.
Now, I'm sure a lot of listeners in the UK will be familiar with both of you guys from their frequent appearances at various industry events and conferences here. But for those outside of the UK, I think it'd be useful to start off with a couple of brief bios on your respective careers in the industry so far. So, Helen, you go first. How long have you been working in the industry now and where has it taken you?
Longer than Chris, because we just had an argument about this. Since around 2002, so a long time. So I've seen a lot of change over that period. My background has always been an affiliate, so I've sort of gone through every role there is, sort of starting, you know, as account exec all the way up to account manager, senior account manager, account director, and then sort of managing affiliate teams and working client side at Sky for a few years, which was fascinating. I think working client side gave me a very different perspective on the affiliate world. So I guess I've always done this. My role now is very different, though. It's much more around kind of growth and development, but always with sort of affiliate in mind. Like, how do we get the affiliate idea and partnerships economy out to the wider world, which is always something I've been passionate about anyway. But yeah, I've always done affiliate. Haven't really done anything else.
Well, same question to you, Chris. What's the story of your career so far?
Yeah, mine's, I mean, it's been interesting, I suppose. I think go back to the original. I think I may have talked about this before in a previous podcast, but I was, I guess, going down two avenues. One was an apprentice at Airbus, building plane wings, yeah. Which was one potential choice. Yeah, through to an internet marketing analyst job, which I ended up going for, which ended up working for Matt Wood. Of A4U and PI Live fame. So I was
Hello
there.
Partner fame.
Now Hello Partner fame, yes. You will thank me for that, and thank you for that one. So yeah, I was there for about 10 years, working on something quite old school in terms of a forum, the A4U forum, for those that are listening that do remember that, through to the conference and events and awards. And then I left and moved to the only other Bristol-based affiliate industry company that I could work for at the time, and that was VoucherCloud. And I was there for about 5 years in total. We were acquired by Groupon in May 2018. And then Pastures New moved to Intently, and that's where I am today.
Perfect. Well, I think with all that experience in the room, we're pretty well set to get some useful insights and thoughts on where the industry's heading in 2023. So
it's open.
I'm hoping so, yeah. Otherwise, let's just call this whole thing off now. One of the first topics I was keen to get your take on was to do with industry consolidation and M&A activity. So we saw some notable examples of this last year with Pepper.com's merger with Global Savings Group, which brought together two of the biggest partners in the incentive space globally. But also Helen Acceleration Partners had a big year of acquisitions with Vault Agency, Influencer Response, and also Grovia. I don't think I've left any out there, have I, from last year?
Not from last year, the year before, I think. Must have been when we acquired Streamline, right, which is a US agency, yeah.
So all of those organisations have been bought by AP. And before getting into asking you specifically about AP's strategic direction there with those acquisitions and what they mean for your offering as an individual business, I wanted to just first ask the group whether you think we'll continue to see a lot of industry M&A activity and consolidation in 2023. Start with you, Chris.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's actually a question that has come up quite a lot, I would say, over the past few months. I think it really depends on how you look at it. I think if you look at it on a really macro level, yes, inflation rising and yes, a reduction in spend potentially. But then actually, if you look at the opportunity that exists for, you know, currency rates, FX rates, and a US business that's looking to enter a European market or another global market where all of a sudden the currency makes sense for them to essentially get something at a discount, potentially, that actually could accelerate M&A within the industry. We've seen a few mergers and acquisitions, and I can talk recently about a Yieldify one, which mm-hmm. is, you know, semi-relevant to what us as a competitor. So I think there's definitely big corporates still looking at this. I don't think it will slow down. If anything, I think it might speed up.
Are you talking in the industry specifically, or kind of wider kind of activity occurring?
Yeah, I think wider. I think we've kind of rode a wave a little bit in the last sort of 6 to 8 months. I think we will see a continuation of acquisitions. I think mergers maybe more so, mm-hmm. Maybe joint activity. Mm-hmm. I think there's complementary businesses that probably could do a lot of business together and kind of ride the storm a little bit more. But yeah, I think we're essentially coming out into Pastures New, and this is online digital, right? So what may be not quite relevant for more traditional retailers or traditional businesses for online retail, I think we're probably in a good position to see more of that this year.
Yeah. Do you agree with that, Kev?
Well, I was going to ask Chris whether he thought that, like, within our industry, there's lots of obviously small companies, which could be, for a lot of other companies, very affordable. And so I wonder whether there is an opportunity, actually, yes, strip all of the economic climate out of everything, but actually is an opportunity for businesses to either pick off kind of smaller, more far more sort of strategic kind of optimization pieces, which is, I suppose, where the tech partner space within the industry is quite interesting, or whether using the publicist example about you know, they've recently partnered with that agent, that Czech agency, where they obviously don't have reach in Eastern Europe. And I just wonder whether they see that as a, there's an opportunity there just to purely expand. And it's just to get into markets that they're not currently in.
I think market share is, you know, yes, that's a good way into, I guess, acquiring a new market. Yeah, you might find there are some businesses that do things that you currently do better than how you do it. And actually that could be a way to, I say, grow and accelerate what you're doing. And then I think there's plenty of tie-ups that make a lot of sense. But I think all in all, yeah, smaller businesses for their agility probably are quite attracted to larger businesses. I think if you look at the online tech space, but you know, the reason why we are so able to do what we do for retailers, it's a lot of the time it's because speed to market, speed to be understanding that there are opportunities to, you know, the traffic is up and trying to convert that traffic. So to build that internally, to get tech resource, to then get that through, you know, scrums and wall tools and all these other things that goes on and within these big businesses, there is an easier win. And I think that's where it becomes quite attractive.
I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you saw, but M&S bought, I think they bought them out of administration, didn't they? I can't remember the name of the company now. But they're basically a company that were based around basket optimization. And that I thought was really interesting because technically that's a company that could have been an affiliate company, an affiliate tech player. And I do wonder, and it was always really interesting as well, the fact that it was a really big retailer. It wasn't just somebody that didn't have the internal resource necessarily to do it. They just saw a very good opportunity to plug that tech into their existing tech stack.
I guess it's always that question you have as a company. It's, do you build or buy? And it's, you know, what's the cost of building it and the time of building it versus, like, is there someone out there that you can just buy and bring it in? Which, like, I mean, we've done a bit of both. I think we've sort of built out, particularly our European expansion, we've built out, but oh my word, it's hard, it takes a long time, costs a lot of money as well. And I can see why it's attractive for people to buy that in, particularly for the expansion, like you were saying about publishers and a Czech company. It makes a lot of sense because they're already established, they have their clients, like it's easier. But I think whether it sort of speeds up or slows down, stays the same, I think will depend on market confidence. And I think that's really difficult to judge at the moment. I think we are lucky in our industry that I think it is an attractive place to invest money because it's growing, it's, you know, partner marketing, it's broad, it's got good return on investment, clients like it, it's very attractive. But whether people will get spooked over the next year, particularly I think in UK and Europe, we'll have to see. But I think there's still a lot of opportunity out there, so fingers crossed.
Just to go back to Acceleration Partners' own specific approach here, what's the intention of those acquisitions? And by buying those particular companies, does it change the status for your business of being perhaps a more consultative or service-based business to something that's closer or more akin to kind of more of a tech platform almost?
Yeah, I think, so the way we view it, we're always trying to add value to our clients or our people, which I think generally the same thing. So if we make our people's lives easier, it often makes our clients' life easier. If there's something that we think is really valuable to clients, it often works well for people. So they're the two things we always look at. I think we are a service company for good and bad, and I don't think we're going to change that. But I don't think we can ignore the fact that technology is such an important part of our industry now. We see it more from like an efficiency and automation point of view. Like, can we make things easier for our people so they can spend more time doing strategy and like things that we think add a lot of value? So that's where we sort of are interested in the tech side. But most of our sort of acquisitions to date, so sort of Streamline, Grovia and Influencer Response and Vault, have been about adding services and adding competencies that we didn't have. So it's that kind of buy versus build. And I think particularly in the influencer space, like, we can add a lot of value to our clients from doing that.
So I've got a question for you. So, because Rob and I were talking about this earlier, I guess realistically, if you would scroll back like 5-6 years, you'd say, well, Acceleration Partner in the kind of like traditional US sense of being like an APM, performance marketing agency. But now you've got these additional services. How do you package that up and how do you position that in the market?
Yeah. So I think, look, as an agency, I think we're in a very strong and unique position that we can offer, because we see it as a partnership economy. Sorry, I know that's a phrase that other people use, but everyone's used it. Sorry. Partnership marketing, whatever we call it. So that's how we see it. And we think, like, there's lots of different ways we can work with clients to introduce them to different partnerships and do it on a performance basis. So everything we do is always with that in mind. So all the influencer stuff work we're doing, so we've been sort of building this and now we've added with the agencies that we've bought, is still around performance. It's like, how can we make influencer work on a performance basis? Like, might not be paying on performance all the time, but we're certainly measuring it and tracking it, which is, you know, fundamentally the DNA of what we do in partnership marketing. So I think we see ourselves as the sort of middleman to introduce partnerships to clients and do it in a way which is cost effective and drives a good ROI, and I think that's why it's so attractive, why the whole industry is so attractive at the moment.
I wanted to move on. You mentioned influencer as obviously a big kind of component, I guess, of your direction at the moment, and the wider industry as well. It's kind of reflected with that. So we've seen influencer activity increasingly merge with performance and affiliate marketing over the last few years. Do you think that the possibility of a global recession on the horizon is going to impact that trend negatively, or actually it might accelerate that merging towards the performance end of the spectrum?
Yeah, I think the evidence all points towards accelerating. I mean, it's a fast-growing sector at the moment, and it's, you know, so broad. Like, you have your really big influencers that everyone knows about, but the sort of nano and micro influencer world is, I think, where sort of affiliate and partnerships probably sits more, is hugely attractive and growing. I think clients see it as valuable. They're starting to see really good return on investment on it. I think it will move more and more to a performance basis. But I want to be careful on that, though, because what we found, because we've been doing this for some time, sort of trying to figure out the way the land lies. And the sort of paying lots of money up front for influencers doesn't work. Like, you know, you're just spending a load of money and you don't know what your return is. But also it doesn't work just on a performance basis either. Like, the middle ground is where it really works. So it's sort of tracking on performance and paying someone performance, but also doing campaigns and sort of paying influencers to promote things or sending them samples and stuff. So that's where I think the interesting bit is. It's like bringing all the good stuff we know about performance together with the traditional influencer paid stuff, and that's where I think it will really accelerate and work. It's where we're seeing a lot of growth at the moment.
What about, do you have any view on that?
Definitely not as much as Helen will. It's not somewhere that we spend a huge amount of time. I think from a where we are dealing with clients, we've seen a lot more requests where influencers are driving a lot more traffic, and so they do want to, you know, highlight them, especially for the point of doing additional shopping elsewhere or going to look at competitor sites or so on. They want to reinforce the messaging that that influencer has brought them to the site in the first place. So it does show signs that it's taking hold, you know, among more and more retailers as it goes. I think on a macro level, you talk about a global recession. I think if anything, that's just going to play into the hands of the arts of distraction, really. And so there'll be more people scrolling through their phones, and, you know, influencers are everywhere, and they crop up in many places. So if anything, that will only add fuel to that fire, I would imagine.
There's an interesting tension, I feel like, within the wider influencer space, in that where these influencers build up their audiences and their communities is obviously on the major social platforms. And those platforms have tried with varying degrees of success to bring commerce into their platforms, and yet we've just seen Instagram roll back its kind of shopping tab within that particular environment, which I think is a really interesting tactical switch from them, because everything seemed to be kind of like funneling towards, well, that's going to be the future, social commerce is the future, and clearly for them, at least in the current context, that isn't the case, and they've tested it and found that it's not really working quite right. And it feels like perhaps actually when you talk about micro and nano influencers in particular, you know, partnerships at scale is still going to be something that's largely going to be kind of like premised upon the advertiser's ability to build that community themselves across different platforms and then to try to coordinate, manage and measure it more effectively.
Yeah. And I wonder if, I think, like, I agree, I think it's really interesting to sort of move in the opposite direction as what you'd think of Instagram. I wonder whether the challenge is, I don't know for sure, I still think there's a, like, we've always had this in affiliate and partnerships, right? The attribution problem. I think the problem is they're just naturally maybe not right at the end of the sale. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they are about raising brand awareness, they're about introducing people to the brand, they're about getting them into new products. And I think that is something that the influencer and partnership world are probably going to need to work out to really understand the value. I think I wouldn't be surprised if that's part of the issue. But
I think that, coming back to the economic points as well, I think that we're already starting to see it here in the UK. There are a number of brands that are already starting to focus in on how consumers can stretch their money further, be it, you know, supermarket buys or, you know, wherever that may be. And I think that will probably, they will be looking for really authentic influencers, people that are really going to be able to support that kind of, because it's quite a sensitive message. You know, they're not necessarily going to want to do stuff that's really flashy or show offy, because they know that their customers are feeling the pinch on a daily basis. So I think they'll probably be looking to partner with, they'll be looking to networks from an affiliate perspective to find them partners that are really authentic and that can really help them sensitively connect with consumers in light of the cost of living crisis.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of one answer to my next question. But you can take this obviously in a lot of different directions. But Chris, we'll start with you. Like, so from a wider macro perspective, what do you see as being the kind of likely outcomes of this tough economic environment that we're all in right now, on specifically the affiliate industry's growth? And are there any specific developments that you see emerging as a consequence of, you know, declining consumer confidence, like marketing budgets, you know, being slashed? Is there anything that you see there as being particularly likely this year?
It's a good question. I think, if anything, as always, the resilience of the affiliate channel in times like this only ever really goes a particular direction. I think it's a positive thing for the channel. And I think that generally speaking, everyone's looking for things to be more measurable. I was reading an article, I think, yesterday around how CMOs of the future are going to have performance knowledge and metrics, and you've got to be very analytical, and because it is getting to that point where everything is being measured and measured further. Mm. And if we're talking about influencers becoming, you know, part of that, and, you know, measurability as well, and understanding really what their value is and where they sit in the chain and where, you know, the attribution elements to that. I can't necessarily see it go any other way, I think. And there'll be more people potentially that are turning to this. I think the more people becoming personas as well to drive advertisements and, you know, individuals. So I don't generally see, for the industry at least, being a negative thing.
Yeah.
Do you have an Instagram, Chris?
Yeah, but you definitely...
How many followers do you have?
Not many, but what I do know is that when I do post, I hardly ever post, so everyone gets a post about the fact that I've posted, and then I seem to get a lot of comments, so maybe I should do a bit more.
You need to monetize that.
What would you influence?
Not a lot. Football, maybe. Maybe.
Oh, you could be a Bristol City influencer.
I could try. Yeah, I'd be up for that. Sure, if anyone's listening from
there. What would you influence?
Norwich City.
Yeah, there's only a few things I like. Norwich City, cycling. I think they've both been done.
We're moving on to your actual area of expertise. One of the consistently bright spots of growth in the industry over the last few years, I think, has been in the tech partner space. So, Chris, you've worked for several different publisher companies in the industry over the years, as you kind of outlined at the start, and you've got a good idea, I think, of how advertisers' view of the value of affiliates and affiliate marketing more generally has probably evolved in that time. So my question for you is, what is it about the tech partner space right now that you think seems to be resonating with them? And how do you expect that part of the industry to develop this year?
Yeah, it's I think largely it comes down to a lot of what we talked about earlier, in that kind of taking that one individual thing becoming an expert within it, and then really making that available to businesses. And I don't know how many brands Aben works with currently. I mean, you're probably in the tens of thousands, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
Being able to do things more quickly, being able to do them with the expertise behind it and willing to pay for that on a performance way, especially when you're talking about industry, it's kind of a win-win, because providing you've got the trust behind and that the within the businesses people know what you're doing, and the fact that you are an on-site provider, there is a lot more hoops to jump through in order to be able to work successfully and to understand what's going on, and that there aren't UX designers, let's say, or you know, people that you wouldn't expect to have a say in potentially like for our example showing an overlay. But actually, yeah, there is a lot more people that need to know about what we're doing. So providing that's all there, the trust is there, the transparency, and that there are driven the metrics that we stick to, it's I think that's why there's a lot of buy-in at the moment on that, and the speed to get things live, you know. And again, to reference earlier, to do things internally sometimes at these blue chips and, you know, large brands, and it can take a long time. And then by that point, you have produced something, it's probably outdated. You know, we're constantly in that kind of smaller realm, being able to rehash what we do to improve it, to constantly kind of make it more efficient. And so it's a continuous cycle for us. Whereas, yeah, I think it can stagnate if not adopted and really spent a lot of time in internally.
So I've got a question for you. So when you were at Groupon or VoucherCloud, you kind of spent quite a long time kind of evolving how we talk about specifically the central metric of vouchers, and kind of building out kind of wider brand campaigns for the advertisers that you worked with. And that was kind of seen as a way of sort of evolving, I guess, making vouchers more sophisticated in a way that people kind of saw it as a fairly blunt instrument, and building like broader campaigns around it. How are you repositioning, or how are you continuing to think about how you position what you do now? And also, another question for you, when you go and talk to brands now versus when you talk to them when you're at VoucherCloud, do they see what you do? Do they see it as another affiliate partner, or do they see it as a tech play slightly different?
I think with the voucher space, it's essentially, it's a mass consumer behavior. So it's not necessarily, you know, it's born out of a mass consumer behavior. So when you talk about the behavior elements, you know, you've got price anchoring and scarcity value and a lot of these tools and techniques that marketing has used for years and years, it's just one element of that. You know, we will actively have, as part of our to keep people back and put people back on the purchase path through our tech, we will incentivize, we'll try to incentivize a user sometimes, because that is actually the best way to put them back onto the right path. So it is a metric, and again, it's always comes down to the value that you add. So if you're buying into campaigns where you're doing with brands, and you are you're able to show the value, it's not just this sort of blunt instrument, as you call it. It's more of a case of, no, we can do this, and we've got an email database that does this. You can see some of the acquisitions. So, you know, user generated content, the sort of the pepper scenario, I imagine, is something that is useful to them, but also, you know, is another innovation that you know, keeps potentially new audiences, and the way of finding new audiences, or changing people's behaviours. But so there's value in all of it, and I think from our side, people look at us as I guess when you're on site, it's easy, you can dial those needles up and down quite quickly, and it's not necessarily the weirdest way to describe how we are. Essentially, is that we are not a traffic provider, we're not a traffic source, which for affiliates you generally assume that you're bringing some sort of traffic to the website. Generally speaking, we're actually more about the existing traffic and converting that better in a better way. So it's a slightly different tune to what I guess people are used to, and you're talking about a typical affiliate model, which is why we get called a non-traditional affiliate model. But then you go back 5-6 years, or maybe even 10 years now, and cashback was a non-traditional model, and you know, these things become commonplace. And I think it's just sort of nature of the evolution of our industry.
I think it's that what you kind of landed upon there as being a distinct USP maybe for what tech partners represent and the value that they can bring is why we kind of started to think about this whole clock model idea of like pre-purchase is where traditional affiliate kind of sits, and you can drive traffic over to an advertiser's site for it to then hopefully convert. Actually, during that purchase phase on the retailer's website is where technology partnerships suddenly kind of like really underline their value, because they can help kind of maybe improve that conversion rate by 1 or 2%. And that's massive, like particularly right now when marketing budgets are being slashed, and that ability to go out into the market and try to compete for a new customer, actually if you're in a, your budget's been slashed and you're unable to do that to the same degree, why not focus on the traffic that is already coming over to your website, optimizing that? And actually, that's revenue that, you know, didn't exist before that now does exist.
There's more competition. There's new websites every day. There's new retailers, e-commerce, Shopify platforms, all that sort of stuff. There's more competition. There's your Amazons. There's the, you know, you've really got to, when you do have traffic to your site, you really do have to now work harder to convert that traffic.
Mm. Marginal gains, Helen.
Yeah, marginal gains. I can tell you all about that.
Go on then.
Yeah. How long have you got?
Not long.
It's mainly to do with my bike, though. New wheels make it go faster.
You were alluding to, I think, in the article around, you know, CX and customer experience, yeah, and how actually that is important. And we see that through our Coz product that we have, which is an analytical tool as opposed to anything else. But we see that, you know, when the codes don't work, when people come to the site and try codes that don't work, they convert. Some people still purchase with them, but they convert at about 15%. Mm-hmm. But when a code does work and it does take money off at the basket, it does convert around 50, 60%. Mm-hmm. And so then you talk about those little needles and saying, okay, well, actually, if we can improve the quality of traffic coming to the site, mm, or actually offering better content or actually improving that user journey, then everyone's winning in that respect. And CX is, you know, people are talking more about CX as a key metric for them now. Mm.
Mm. One thing you said earlier, which I thought was interesting, and I think it's kind of exactly what Rob said, like, surely as an advertiser, like, if you can convert the traffic that's already coming to your site better, like, that's a no-brainer. Are you finding, because it is about UX and conversion rates, are you finding there's sort of more interest from non-affiliate people on the client side, so the people that look after the site or are responsible for user experience, are they, like, interested in more in what you're doing because they're probably under pressure, right, to increase conversion on site?
Yeah, they actively become, I think, the nature, because you are on site and you are, you know, you're disrupting, I suppose, but in a positive, you know, a positive disruption, you're innovating on their site, so you naturally reach more people. Yeah. So again, if we were to launch on a big brand, you know, it would go up to SLT level probably now to really understand what we're doing, how we're doing it, the test environments. You know, there's all these things that we, compliance and, you know, frameworks that you all have to adhere to. So it's, mm-hmm, one of those, because of that, you do tend to meet those outside of the e-com channels as well. It does put us on the map, but it is, you know, there's a lot of trust that has to go into what we do when it comes to working with retailers on that basis.
It's interesting.
So that, the question, I mean, you mentioned it, but scaling that up must be like a core focus for you. How do we make things more efficient internally so we can work with more people more quickly?
Yeah. Say that again for me.
Scaling up.
Yeah.
Well, because you mentioned sort of, you know, about like traditional affiliates is more sort of like, I would say you can see the application, you switch them on and off they go. Mm. Whereas for you, it's a strategic conversation that you have to have probably with lots of different people, mm, at different levels of seniority within a business, as well as all of the technical conversations, the compliance conversations, the data, the privacy conversations, all of those things. So
yeah, it's like a managed service to a point, you know, because you can have SaaS style models where you can pay for a service, but and it does a lot of the hard work for you. But equally, you know, we have a team. They read the data. They understand what's going on the website. They have, you know, we have tools that can highlight and fine tune the optimizations that they're a lot of the time not aware of themselves. You can some key like exit pages or bounce pages that you would maybe assume that people are aware of. And actually, great example recently was somebody, it was like their blog was their biggest, you know, big retailer, but their blog was actually one of their highest exit pages. And you're like, and they're doing nothing on those pages to try and put people back onto the purchase path. Yeah. And so there is an element, I mean, of understanding and from the scalability aspect to it, you know, it's the good thing is it's all about conversions for us. It's all about metrics and analysing that purchase journey. And it's not necessarily about which website or which vertical it's on. It's all relevant to each one. The messaging can be tailored, but the messaging is still A/B tested, you know, it's all relevant to, and it crosses those different verticals. So it becomes a quite a prominent offering to many people. It just takes that bit of time to, I think, to gain the buy-in. But I think that is also changing now. That's getting more positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wanted to just move on to probably like the last kind of broad predictions question for you guys. But at the moment, it feels like everyone is obviously all aboard this AI in marketing hype train at the moment with the release of ChatGPT. I'm sure you've all kind of played around with it a little bit. My LinkedIn feed is chock full of self-appointed experts talking about how the solution is going to revolutionize and transform copywriting, marketing strategies, etc. But from an affiliate perspective, what do we speculate might be the impact of this new technology suddenly being much more accessible? And obviously, they're talking about GPT-4 being made available later in the year. That's an order of magnitude even more sophisticated. Where do you think this is going, Helen?
Come on, Helen.
Oh, wow. That's a big question. Like you said, so many people have thoughts. Honestly, I don't know from an affiliate perspective. I think it's really interesting from a general perspective, right? Because it's all about efficiency. And it's, you know, if I was in a sector like law right now, I'd be pretty worried because, like, that could basically take over your job because, you know, it knows all the answers and it can get all the answers without people having to do it. Like, I think it's all about efficiency. I think there's lots of opportunity in it in terms of probably content and affiliate content, but I don't know. I'm still a little bit skeptical about how good it will be. I think it'd be interesting to see when the sort of next rollout comes in, how unique it will be, how it will sort of target the right market without having some sort of human sort of interaction with it. I don't know. I think from an efficiency point of view, writing content, thinking about articles, all that stuff, I think it's good. Where it sits with affiliate, I'm not entirely sure outside of efficiency, but
Chris?
We'll see.
Well, I must be honest. I've been sent a link to
ChatGPT. You're going to say you've been sacked because of it.
I've been sent the link to that about 10 times internally at the team, and I've not actually had the chance yet to have a proper good look at it. Okay. However, I would say that regardless of what it pumps out, I don't think I'm going to be able to go and sit and have a beer with a technology such as that.
Yeah, but people don't want to do that anymore. Chris. Yeah. Like, the world, young people don't want to.
Kids don't drink anymore.
Non-alcoholic beer is absolutely fine too. But I think, you know, people, there's still going to be a place for us all. And I think you know, the power of people is underestimated still. But yeah, it's something I've not yet actually had a good look at, but yeah. I certainly will.
But in a way, if you kind of look at it from a reporting point of view, I mean, things like machine learning have been offering recommendations and data can be incorporated within reports. And that's been possible for years. And we still don't do a terribly good job of that. I mean, I know that there are, you know, we've got plans to introduce more kind of recommendation-based reporting this year. But I still think that it's going to be a while before people feel comfortable without having a human set of eyes on that. And there are always going to be angles. There are always going to be that more lateral way of thinking, applying, you know, connecting one data set with another data set that you might not necessarily think of, that you can then see a pattern or a trend or an insight from off the base of. And I think that's going to be around for quite a while. There will be a place for smart people, and there will always be need to be smart people that can interpret smart technology.
I think it's interesting in the content world. I think it could replace a lot of things there, but yeah, outside of that, to be seen. But if I was a marketing content writer, I'd be pretty worried right now.
Yeah, Rob.
Sorry, Rob.
Well, I'll tell you what, as soon as they develop an AI that can host a podcast with these dulcet tones, then I'll be worried.
So you're saying it can do essays for you as well, and that's kind of school.
Have you not read any of it? I mean, Rob's like been one of the cheerleaders for it. Most of his content, he just
doesn't have to do anything anymore. Yeah.
I think he's put in the query. Like, that takes work. right, finally, let's do a quick fire predictions round to get your opinion on a bunch of stuff that I didn't get a chance to ask you about and that might happen this year. So what I'll do is I'll say a prediction and you say hit if you think it's likely to happen in 2023 or miss if you don't. And I said hit.
I was going to say, I thought you were going to rhyme it.
You know, hit or miss. Okay. So the first one is affiliate ad spend for the UK goes down in 2022, according to the impending industry report due out in April this year. Helen.
Goes down.
It's always gone up, hasn't it?
Yeah. So. It'll go up. I think it'll still go up.
Yeah.
Okay, I have to agree, I'm afraid. Yeah. I
think what do you mean, I'm afraid? You're supposed to say it's just
a good thing.
No, I know, but I'm sure you're expecting us to be kind of back and forth a little bit on it.
I always thought that was a trick question.
No.
It's like a boring panel, we're just agreeing for the next next five.
Possibly, yeah. We'll wait and see, Kev.
No, I think it will go up, but obviously, in a year's time, it might have gone down this year, but we'll only have 2022's numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from looking at our own numbers that obviously inflation meant that sales. Or revenue was up considerably, yeah. And obviously commission typically tied to sales, whereas sales obviously were a little bit flat. So I just think the nature of inflation means that it's inevitable that it's going to go up.
It maybe won't be the same growth as we've seen over the last few years, but I think any growth this year will probably be good.
Yeah. Okay, next one. Following Google's strategic partnership with coupon code feed aggregator FMTC in the US, which was announced, I think, in December last year, to show generic retailer discounts within its shopping and search results, the tech giant will roll this initiative out globally. Hit or miss in 2023, Helen?
I'm going to say miss.
You don't think they'll do that?
No. I just always think about their Google affiliate network. How much of a disaster that
they
was.
They just can't scale anything. No, I don't. Kind of a bit more manual.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a hit and then probably a miss afterwards because I think it really does depend. You know, I've seen obviously screenshots of it. I've not actually seen it in action physically myself, but it really does depend, you know, when those codes appear, whether those codes are working. There might be generic codes from a feed, which... I'm sure that the validity rates for FMTC is up there, but you know, is it providing a good user experience and consumer experience? Is it eating into margin? If it's sure on more generic terms, you know, people are when they are searching for those terms, they are looking, you know, essentially for a discount. But when they're not, you know, is it still going to show then? Is that actually going to be well received by retailers? Probably not. So it will be interesting to see how that gets rolled out. I think there's definitely value in it for a point whether it stays.
Kev.
Yeah, I mean, brands have a fairly love-hate relationship with codes, and the key thing that they want is control. So I think if they perceive or they feel that they don't have control, then that's going to potentially damage big client relationships, which I'm sure Google won't want to do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but in terms of what they actually do, I don't know. I mean, they have a history of rolling stuff out and then rolling it back pretty quickly, don't they? So.
Yeah.
But fair play to FMTC.
Good deal.
I mean, I was talking to a colleague about this recently, and we were wondering what might be the impact in Europe specifically because of CSS, obviously, being a really established partner model now that's been hugely valuable to a lot of retailers, and what bearing that might have on those publishers, whether it might actually, ironically, invite yet more EU kind of legal action against Google because they're then kind of introducing another, like they had to establish CSS because of the EU's decision. And now they're kind of like coming back into it with another competitive product that arguably kind of
shuts
could wipe them
out.
So all sorts of weird consequences there. Okay, next one. Shopify acquires a major affiliate marketing platform as it aims to further bolster its marketing capabilities for brands using its e-commerce solution.
Trust him.
Hit or miss.
Love the way you make Helen go first all the time. Yeah. So she can't just go, yeah, no, I agree. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going to say hit. I think that's interesting. I think they are an incredible company that have done some amazing things over the last few years. I love their model. I think it's really, really smart. I think it's got a lot of legs in it, particularly for that sort of small, medium business area. I wish I'd thought of it as really smart. So I'm going to say hit.
I think they acquired an influencer marketing platform last year.
I think you might be right.
They kind of like seem to be broadening their reach into the marketing kind of space right now. But yeah. Chris?
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. I could see that. It's it makes total sense. And they're a fast moving company. So I wouldn't discount that at all.
I mean, they do charge us for every integration. So they would be switching off a revenue source, but how big that revenue source is overall, I don't know.
Unless they acquired us.
Yeah, true.
Okay, a new affiliate platform or solution built on GPT-3 or 4 will launch, promising full service management to advertisers without any actual human account managers.
Done that one.
I'll go in anti-clockwise direction this time, Kev.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Everyone's going to be out of a job by the end of the year.
Heard it here first.
No chance.
No chance.
No chance.
No, but it does sound quite fun. I like the idea.
That's the thing. Fun, what are you going to do?
Well, maybe we could still, like, what's the Scandinavian model where, like, you get a salary, don't you, but robots do the work?
Universal basic income.
Like, but extending that to robots do the work, but we all get an income. Like, we could just chill out all the time and go on holiday.
So, I mean, yeah, I think I've phrased that one specifically to say we'll launch rather than we'll be successful. I reckon I could see it happening, but like whether or not it actually makes any headway.
They're still going to need people there anyway, aren't they? Like to answer the phones and all the ways you get robots to do that.
Robots can do it.
Okay, next one, penultimate one. Mark Zuckerberg abandons his plans for the metaverse following shareholder anger at the losses the business is suffering in 2023. Hit or miss?
Hit.
Yeah.
It's such a... I hate the metaverse. It makes me upset and angry on so many levels.
What do you like about it?
I don't like the idea that, like, people are just going to be sitting there in their own little weird virtual worlds and not
We could have hosted this very podcast with our avatars.
With our little avatars.
You could have been a dragon. Yeah. Chris could have been a...
People do that on the tube, though, when they're just staring at their phones.
I hate it. Like, and this is from someone that, like, says a lot. I don't particularly like hanging around with people very often, but like that is an extreme even for me to be sitting in a metaverse. I don't know. If you've read the book Snow Crash as well, like it's
I've heard about it. Is it William Gibson?
I can't remember. I'm gonna go, that's gonna happen.
Okay.
It'd be funny too.
Chris?
Probably I'm out of the loop with it a little bit. It's not something I've invested a lot of time in, if I'm honest, but I think I did see Mark's Facebook announcement where the avatars now had legs or something.
It just resulted in something that's 25 years old.
It resulted in a massive eye roll for me, I think. And that's kind of, I think when I still hear the term, I still eye roll. So not sure what that says. Probably not good. Maybe I'm just out of touch.
Kev, you're into the metaverse.
I mean, the word meta kind of describes it in that it's like meta from the internet, like circa 1995.
Yeah,
it just looks ridiculous.
I think that's what it's called in Snow Crash. I think, like, because it is a virtual one. I think it's called Meta. I think that's where he got the name from.
Okay,
so he even copied them.
Okay, last one, and I reckon this should be a fairly simple one. Towards the end of the year, Google will again postpone the depreciation of cookies within Chrome by another year to 2025. Hit or miss?
Eye roll again.
Hit. Definitely will. They keep doing it. They're going to do it for as long as they can get away with, I think.
Do you think?
Yeah. Well, as long as I can get away with it, it's probably a key part, but maybe that's just being skeptical.
I really don't know. I mean, I think it's a hit too, because it's just too much revenue from their side, I think. Core revenue for them. And yes, there's I can't see any other solutions coming anytime, quickly.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I've got to be contradictory, haven't I? Like we've all agreed with each other. I think they're definitely going to do it, and we'll all be out of a job by the end of the year.
That's been your answer to every prediction.
But we're going to get a salary.
We'll be fine.
No, we'll be fine. First party cookies.
Sit in the metaverse.
Third server.
Well, I think that's all the time we've got for today's episode. So I just want to thank our guests for coming in person to come down and talk to us. And we wish you both all the best for the new year.
Thanks.
Thank you. With all your M&A activity. For the year. Silence.
But that's all we've got time for. So it's goodbye from me, goodbye from Kev.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye from Chris.
Ciao.
And goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.